send messages to Rome saying that Augustus is dead and that for the time being, at least, the command of the Roman Empire devolves upon me.
Tiberius, are you trying to deny me any part in the governing of this empire?
Yes, Mother.
Welcome back again to the Life of Tiberius, episode 35. Where did we end last time, Papa Bear?
Yeah, the great Julia Augusta, Augustus's wife, Tiberius's mother, has passed on. She was 86 years old. And depending on who you believe, this is now going to be a time when Tiberius and Sejanus are either going to give in to their true nature or their darker demons or whatever, but it's about to get turned up to 11 in Rome because the last adult has left the room.
Yes. Now, apparently, a little bit before she died, according to some of the old sources, Thibaut wrote a letter to the Senate attacking both Agrippina and her son Nero. Now, some of the old sources say that Livia sort of held on to the letter, somehow intercepted it. But then other modern scholars say, well, that doesn't make any sense. Yeah. How could she do that?
He would just write another letter. Yeah.
Either way, the timing, I guess, seems pretty suspicious, which might be why the old sources said that, because as soon as she died, this letter, which didn't have time to get from, news didn't have time of her death to reach Capri and then for Tiberius to write a letter and it come back to the Senate. So the timing was a little bit too fast, I guess. But
yeah,
a letter hit the Senate attacking both Agrippa and Nero. And what did it accuse them of, Ray?
Well, as far as Nero is concerned, you would think that, you know, if you're going to try to take out the next person in the line, the prince, the future leader, it would be something intense, like he's trying to lead an armed rebellion. No, the letter accused him of leading a dissolute life. And again, as for Agrippina, it wasn't that she was the focal point of an armed rebellion or a coup d'etat in the Senate. She was willfully disobedient to authority. And I'm guessing here by authority, they mean Tiberius's authority. But those are the charges.
Yeah, I've got Tacitus accuses Nero of, Tacitus says that Tiberius accuses Nero of unnatural passions and profligacy.
Okay. Now,
what the hell could pass for unnatural in Rome? What's an unnatural passion? Rome's pretty much anything goes, it's like as far Vegas. As I can tell.
Yeah.
Is it bestiality? I mean, nobody knows more about bestiality than you, Ray. I mean, how bad does it have to be before it's classified as unnatural passions in Rome?
Well, during the time of Caesar, I think there were a couple of moments when some of Caesar's men gang rape a cow. So it would have to be pretty bad. So I don't know. It would have to be pretty bad for people to be shocked by this young man's actions, which of course leads me to believe it's bullshit.
Tiberius is accusing Nero of unnatural passions. Meanwhile, on Capri, he's built the world's first BDSM sex dungeon. People are like, well, what about you guys? Well, yeah, but see, here's the thing. I'm the princeps, A, and B, I'm doing it in Capri.
Right.
And that's okay. Capri's like having an offshore company in a tax haven in Panama.
Exactly, a sex haven.
As you said, Vegas. What you do in Capri stays in Capri. Doing it in Capri is one thing. Doing it in Rome, that's not acceptable. anyway, basically he's accusing Nero of being a playboy, a dirty, kinky, sexy playboy, whilst at the same time doing the same stuff himself. And it's more disgusting when he does it because he's in his, 60s.
Right. Everything's
apparently
wrinkled.
Yeah, and he's covered in like fucking sores and all sorts of things. He looks disgusting.
Yeah.
He's not like the Baron Harkonnen in Dune, just covered in pussy sores that right. are weeping, and he's like, suck on my look pussy weeping sore. Don't look at me. Just suck it. Suck on it. Oh.
It sounds like our interview. And you have to remember that Augustus was deflowering young maidens, so it's not like the bar has been set very high. So what the hell is going on? I guess you have to write something in your complaint letter, and this is the best that Tiberius can come up with.
Yeah, that's what he can come up with. Oh, he's having sex! Oh, really? Wow, oh, we're so shocked, Tiberius. Yeah. Oh.
Yeah. Gasp.
And Tacitus says that Agrippina was accused of having an insolent tongue and defiant spirit.
Yeah. For a woman, insolent. She is.
For a woman, insolent. Yeah. Good if you're a man, not good if you're a woman. An insolent tongue.
Yeah. But here's the thing. I was just going to say this real quick and I won't go too far. But so the Senate gets this letter. Obviously, the letter's read out. And they're like, you know, again, Tibbs, we'll do whatever the fuck you want. But all he does is complain. So all the Senate cared about was, like, where was the verb in that sentence? What do you want us to do? Because we'll fucking do it. But that's not Thibault's way. He is just venting and he's expecting the Senate to get the gist of it.
Now, apparently the Senate sat silent. Say that 10 times fast. Go.
The Senate sat silent. The Senate sat silent. The Senate sat silent. The Senate sat silent. It's gone.
Okay, that was four. That was better than I expected.
Not bad.
The Senate sat silent and terrified as the letter was read out. Nobody wanted to be the one to suggest what action they should take.
Right.
Even the former consul and former proconsul of Asia, Marcus Aurelius Cotta Maximus Messalinus.
Damn.
He eventually suggested severity, taking a severe approach. Right. He was known as a bit of a Thibaut suck-up.
Yeah.
But Junius Rusticus suggested that the Senate shouldn't take any action because Thibaut might calm the fuck down and then regret any action taken against the House of Germanicus. And because Rusticus had been appointed by Tiberius as editor of the Acta Senatus, the official record of senatorial proceedings, it was assumed by a lot of people that he had some sort of hotline into what Tiberius was really thinking. And so when he said, let's not be too hasty on this, what did Augustus say? Haste makes waste or something.
Something. I don't know.
Haste not wanted not? No. Stitch in time makes, no, wasn't that one?
Well, here's what it comes down to. You can't unkill this young man. If you kill him and Tiberius is like, you know, I had a good sulk and I'm over it now. Oh, he's dead? Well, this, you know, this is still the beloved House of Germanicus. And so, but again, this, if you want to call it, this trick works because these other senators, like you said, assume this guy's got some inside scoop. And they're like, you know, they probably really didn't want to come down hard on Germanicus' son. So for a lot of them, this was probably the out they were looking for.
Yeah, but Agrippina is Augustus's granddaughter. She's the blood of the divine Augustus. Nero is his great grandson. Yeah. The blood of Augustus. You can't willy-nilly start killing off the descendants of Augustus, man.
Yeah, but
we've got the Aria patches.
Right. But
it has all of these people on it. I mean, Nero's not on it, but and I don't think Agrippina's on it either because she's a girl. But some, you know, like her parents are on it, Julia and Agrippa. This is the Holy Family. You can't go just whacking members of the Holy Family because...
Whackity whack.
You know, Tibbo's it's having his period. I mean, we need to play our cards carefully right here.
But respect for the bloodline of Augustus is one thing, but the Senate is so spineless at this point, it's actually considered what to do with this young man because of a letter, a vague letter from Tiberius that he is most displeased with this young man and his mother. I mean, this should be a no contest situation, but there was a discussion, there was a debate, and there were those who supported Tiberius who were ready to move forward, but they were not in the majority. So again, this is just another indication of where Rome is at.
Meanwhile, outside the Senate, there was apparently a large protest. Somehow, people knew what was going on inside the Senate.
Yeah.
And had enough time to organize a protest. There were apparently people walking around holding up pictures of Agrippina and Nero and claiming that the letter was a fake. Now, where the fuck do you get pictures of Agrippina and Nero on short notice to hold up at a protest? Did you, like, you can't just go to an office works. What do you call them over there? Like
Kinko's or something like
Tinko's?
That. Kinko's, yeah.
Kinko's. You can't just go to a Kinko's and whack in a USB stick and start printing out these things en masse. What do they have, like an army of quick sketch artists sitting somewhere in Rome and go, hey, quick in, draw me up 50 quick caricatures of Agrippina and Nero. He's like, well, what the fuck do they look like? I don't know what they look like. I don't see them every day. Do you have a photo? Oh, well, no. See, here's
the
problem. Well, we don't have a photo. Look, come to their house. Can you be at their house 10 minutes? And, then you can draw some lifelike pictures of them. We need them for our protest this afternoon. How the fuck does that work?
Look, here's business 101, and I got this from Barry and Stan themselves. It only cost me $100,000. When you have a stall, on one shelf you have drawings, maybe not accurate, of Agrippina and Nero. On another shelf you have drawings or little busts or whatever of Sejanus. And on the third shelf you have some stuff of Augustus and Tiberius and maybe good old JC. And if you really can afford it, you have Marius and Sulla. The point is your shop has got something for everyone, and that's your motto. No matter your needs, we got you covered. No matter which time period of our history you're into, we got you covered. And that's how you stay in business unless Sejanus sees your stall and it gets pissed off and then has you killed and your family. But the point is, you've got to think that there are factions out there that are supporting these two that are going to have something, because it's all a propaganda war. For right now, until the knives start flying, it's all about a war of words, and you have to have images and other stuff ready to go. And there probably were people producing stuff to do their part in this propaganda war that's in Rome.
Yeah, probably right. Fascinating. There were people were running, had pictures of Hitler up on their wall and Germany in the 30s, or Mussolini in Italy. They had pictures of Agrippina and Nero up in their wall.
Fucking A. Yeah.
How did you attach things to walls? Did they have like a Roman version of blue tack? Just like...
You take your gum? No. spit every 15 minutes? I have no idea. A nail.
Yeah. What? Do we have, what do we produce a lot of that's sticky? I don't know, probably just snatching out people's eyeballs.
Yeah.
Using that.
It's got some goo on it.
Now, the protesters were apparently passing around pamphlets which accused Sejanus of acting on his own without Tibbo's knowledge.
Shit.
And they had fake signatures of former consuls on them.
Wow. So they're saying Sejanus is doing this, the family of Germanicus is being ruined, and Tibbo, who is not here, doesn't even know what's going on. That's clearly and squarely putting the blame on Sejanus. That's not going to make him too happy, I guess. But I guess they're still wanting to think the best of Tiberius because they don't know the old sexual lecher that he is.
I don't know, but just the fact that they were signing these things with fake signatures by former consuls to me.
I'll sign Trump's name right now. Give me a piece of paper. I've seen it. Yeah. I've seen it on the news a billion times. I can do it.
I mean, his signature, man, is...
That's fourth grader.
Screams. It screams, I have problems. Just those, the sharp, pointy things.
It's like crayons.
In his signature. Yeah. It just screams like, somebody please help me.
This is the best I can do. You know who he's like? He's like Charlie from Always Sunny in Philadelphia. Can't really read, can't write too well, but I can carve it out.
He signs it by holding a pen in a fist. Yes! And just moving his elbow up and down in straight lines, which is exactly how Charlie writes.
I did good.
Just in the thing. In yeah. It's Charlie work. That's what it is. So, Sejanus, of course, used these fake pamphlets as further evidence that certain members of the Senate were working for Agrippina.
Brilliant.
So... maybe he organized even the protests.
Probably.
So if he knew that this letter was going to get read out, maybe he even organized the protests against the letter. Probably. I wouldn't put it past Sejanus. Like, he's a plotter. By the way, and I said this on Facebook the other day, I went and watched the I, Claudius episodes with Sejanus in there, with Jean-Luc Picard.
I saw that.
Patrick Stewart as Sejanus. Nah, sorry. Like, I know this is heresy for a lot of people, but that show does not really stand up. Listen, don't get me wrong. I'm sure Robert Graves' original material is great. In fact, I read an interview with Orson Welles recently from, 1960. And Orson Welles, they said to him, is there one person you could meet and have dinner with, who would it be? And this is a guy who knew Churchill and FDR and knew everybody who was anybody. He said Robert Graves is the one person he would love to meet. He said, because he's given me so much joy, I would like to just express to him how much joy he's given me. The actors, obviously, that were in I, Claudius were the be-all and end-all of British theatre at the time. At the time, yeah. Some great performances, great actors, but... it doesn't work. I mean, it's shot like Doctor Who was shot back then. Very staid. One camera locked off, doesn't move. The sets are pretty boring. And there's a lot of historical holes in it, which we can explain as we go on. But okay, Patrick Stewart as Sejanus, obviously... I'm watching it knowing him as Jean-Luc Picard and Professor X.
Yeah.
He spent decades playing men of great integrity and deep honor. And he has these eyes that you want to melt into. Like, I'd fuck Patrick Stewart, man. Like, he's got these sexy eyes.
Yeah.
And this deep voice. Like, you know, anyone would get, okay, you can suck my dick, Patrick. I mean, come on, with those eyes and that voice, you'd let him do whatever he wants. Sejanus is supposed to be evil, like evil, murderous, plotter, bastard.
Yeah.
Sorry, like Patrick Stewart just does not work for me. And then John Hurt is Caligula. John Hurt was like 40, and he's supposed to be Caligula in his early 20s.
Good point.
Just he looks way too old to play young, sort of crazy, young, dumb, and full of cum Caligula.
right.
Which Missed is, those days. But why the, so if you compare I, Claudius, made in 76, I think, to Caligula, made in 79, world of difference. I mean, Malcolm McDowell as Caligula, forget about it, man. Like, he is just crazy as a motherfucker in that thing. And the sets, like the Italian sets, Tinto Brass's Italian sets versus the British sets. Forget about it. The other thing that pisses me off about, and this is true, I think, too, for the Caligula one from memory, the statues in I, Claudius, they have busts everywhere. The busts are white marble. We yes. know that the busts weren't white. They were painted back then, but they have all the busts in I, Claudius as white marble.
Yeah.
I'm like, no.
Yeah, get it right.
By the way, when Malcolm McDowell played Caligula, he was the same age that John Hunt was. He was 53, 63, 70. Yeah, he was 36 when he played Caligula. But he looked a lot younger. He looked 25.
Yeah.
I think.
But it's not the anyway. Same.
And yeah. it's got Helen Mirren. Like, hello. It's... Oh,
man. And scene.
She was so hot.
Yeah.
She was so hot. Not enough of her in that film, though, Caligula. We want more Helen Mirren.
Yeah. Yeah.
Anywho, was I up to? Anyway, Sejanus. Yeah. Yes. So maybe he plotted the whole thing. So he was saying to Thibaut, look, it's only a matter of time before the Agrippina party takes up arms against you. Look at this. They're marching in the streets, holding up pictures of her, like she's the princeps.
Ooh, a woman.
They're basically, they're coming for you. We need to strike first.
Yeah. And Thibaut reacts to that because this time he writes a second letter where he chastises the plebs, you know, for the street riots. And he repeats his charges against Nero and Agrippina. And he adds, and how can he not take this personally? He goes, because one senator, Rusticus, stands up and does his little trick, the potential against my life, against the revolt of Rome, is not being taken seriously. That's bullshit. I want this handled. I'll decide what to do. You implement it. That's the way it's going to be. So he is obviously pissed off and yet fearful at the same time, because that's how Sejanus has got him worked up with this second letter. He is not letting this go.
No, but with the second letter, he said, listen, I'll take care of it. Forget about it.
Nah.
I'll take care of it. Yeah. You're useless, obviously. Leave it up to me. I'll deal with it. It will be done. Yeah. It will be dealt with.
Like it should
Don't you
been.
Worry about it.
Right, yeah.
Now the Senate's terrified because they're like, yeah. What's he going to do now? So then they write him back a reply saying, listen, we're ready. We'll kill anyone. We'll fucking kill the whole city. If you hadn't expressly just told us not to do it, we would have gone to Stadio on the whole town. We'll kill ourselves. We'll chop our own dicks off and then burn ourselves alive. We are so ready to do the right thing. But you said not to do anything in your letter dated 2nd of March. A copy is forthwith attached just to cover our asses here in triplicate. But you said don't do anything. But, oh, would we have done things if we had known that you didn't tell us not to do them. Send it out. Peace out. We're all now going to our holiday villas way, way far away because we're really scared. And at this point, unfortunately, Tacitus' account in his annals drops off. Disappears. Oh, gone.
Right.
Doesn't pick up until a couple of years later. Now, I want to take a break. I meant to warn you about this. I want to talk about this a little bit. This Tacitus, the record of Tacitus. Now, ties a little bit into what we've been talking about on the Renaissance show. Now, coincidentally, these years that are missing from Tacitus would also have been the years when Jesus supposedly had his ministry.
Oh, I'm intrigued.
Just so happens that they're missing. Now, some New Testament scholars that I've spoken to in the making of my film suspect that these years of Tacitus were deliberately destroyed by Christians because he either said nothing about Jesus or he shed light on something that ruined the gospel accounts of the story.
Right.
And so they either went, well, yeah, we got to get rid of that.
Yeah, a little surgical, removal.
At the time when, you know, by the time the Christians took over, they just disappeared these sections of Tacitus. Now, that said, there's nothing in the historical record of people pointing that out in Tacitus either.
Right.
Before that point in time. But maybe they did, and those things were destroyed as well. Maybe they eradicated all mention of people mentioning that Tacitus mentioned that, oh, by the way, during these years, we concocted this whole funny Jesus story just to shut the Jews up or something.
Right.
Anyway, the annals of Tacitus survive in only a single manuscript.
Oh, my God.
His annals and his histories, which, by the way, he doesn't call them the annals and the histories. He just wrote. It's sort of modern scholarship that breaks it into the histories is sort of before this sort of more modern period, and the annals is after the modern, after the sort of contemporary period, before the contemporary period, and then the contemporary period, the first century, basically.
Mm-hmm.
Combined, they comprised 30 books in total, but only half of those have survived at all.
Wow.
16 of these, of the original, would have been the annals. The reign of Tiberius takes up 6 books,
mm-hmm.
of which book 5 is missing, which covers the years 30 to 32 CE.
Oh.
The next 6 books are devoted to the reigns of Caligula and Claudius, but books 7 through 10 of those are also missing.
Wow.
And then books 11 and 12 cover the period to the end of Claudius's reign. Now, the first 6 books of the Annals survived in a single manuscript written in Germany about 850, probably in the Benedictine Abbey of Fulda that we talked about recently on the Renaissance podcast, because it's where Poggio found the only surviving manuscript of Lucretius.
Good for them.
So it probably, and we talked about how this was a major abbey during the Carolingian Renaissance. So like one of the main scholars of the Carolingian period had a student. That student became the head abbot at Fulda and took a shit ton of manuscripts with him in the 8th, 9th century. And it survived. So there was one manuscript of the Annals, which never got copied.
Wow.
And managed to survive getting destroyed, the
worms,
rages of time. Yeah. As we've talked about on the Renaissance show, these papyri, as it probably was, 850 it was probably written. If it was written in 850, it was probably written on
skins.
Calf skin or something like that. So the good thing about writing on skins is the skins survive a long time, but not forever. They can survive centuries, but depending on how they're kept, they can be eaten by worms, they can be destroyed by mold, dirt, dust. Quite often, monks would scrape the ink off them to clean them so they could write a Christian book over the top of them. But anyway, for whatever reason, luck probably, the single manuscript covering the first 6 books of the Annals, all the Tiberius stuff that we've been talking about, without this single manuscript, we wouldn't have been able to do this podcast.
Right.
We have bits from Suetonius and Cassius Dio, but mostly we're getting this out of Tacitus. So without this single manuscript written about 850 stored in the middle of Germany, which is where the Benedictine Abbey of Fulda was, and then rescued by somebody during the Renaissance, this we wouldn't know any of this fucking story.
Yeah.
So sometime after it was written, the manuscript was transferred to another Benedictine monastery called Corvey in Saxony. There it apparently remained without ever being copied. And in 1508, it was removed from the library. We know this because we have a letter from Pope Leo X in 1517 indicating that the manuscript had been stolen and that he had paid a large amount of money for it.
Oh, my God.
And he wanted to get it back. And then somehow they got it back. So it passed back into the hands of Pope Leo X. Mm-hmm. He gave the manuscript to Filippo Beraldo the Younger, who used it to produce the first printed edition in 1515.
Wow, that is amazing. Pope wanted it back. Pope got it back.
So, yes, now the monks of Corvey apparently sent a letter to the Pope asking for the return of it. So I don't know. He'd paid a large amount of money, but then they wanted it. Maybe he paid a large amount of money to get it so he could copy it. We know from our Renaissance show that they would often borrow, if they could, they would borrow these documents to copy them and send them back. Most people couldn't get that, but obviously the Pope probably had enough authority to say, get it. But even he had to pay money for it to get a copy of it. They asked for it back, and instead he sent them a copy of the printed volume. Along with an indulgence. All right, listen, I'm not giving you back the original.
But
here's a printed version and a get-out-of-jail-free card the next time you rape a child. are we good? We're good? We're good. Okay, thanks very much. Good doing business with you.
Pope yours out. In Christ, Pope.
Now, that manuscript today is in Florence at the Biblioteca Medicea Lorenziana. Lorenzo di Medici's manuscript museum, which was, I walked past every day when we were in Florence. It was just down a little laneway from where my hotel was.
Nice.
I didn't go in because I didn't have time, but the next time I go back to Florence, I'm going to try to get to see Tacitus, baby.
That would be amazing. That would be amazing.
Tacitus.
Yeah.
Yeah, that would be amazing. Now, books 11 to 16 of the Annals and what remains of the histories also survived in a single manuscript. This one was written at another Benedictine abbey called Monte Cassino, southeast of Rome. Mm-hmm. Also today it's preserved in the Laurentian Library, probably written around 1038 to 1055 CE. So a couple of hundred years older than this other one. There is some evidence that it was copied only once in about 1,000 years.
Jesus.
And that this copy that was written around 1050 was made from an original that was written in the 5th century or earlier. And they can tell that because some of the way the characters were written were copies of earlier script, and there were some notes in the sidelines and the margins of this one referring to how it was translated. So anyway, it had only been copied once in 1,000 years.
Oh my God! God is great.
And obviously the one that praise be, the one that it was copied from, gone. The 4th or 5th century one. We have this one from the early to mid 11th century, and it seems to have been rescued from Monte Cassino by our old friend Boccaccio.
Oh, really?
Or Boccaccio, as most people call him,
Right.
He is the first person to mention it in the Renaissance period. Now, he says, I found the library shamefully neglected, without bolt or lock, grass growing in the windows, dust thick on the books, monks using the precious manuscripts for turning out prayer books, which they sold for a few soldi to women and children.
Jeez.
So if Boccaccio hadn't stolen this manuscript out of the Abbey of Monte Cassino, we wouldn't have...
We'd be lost.
We wouldn't know anything, really, about the reigns of Caligula or Claudius.
Wow. Thank you again.
Then...
Yeah.
From Boccaccio, it ended up in the hands of book collector Niccolò Nicolai,
mm-hmm.
who we've mentioned briefly on the Renaissance series, but we'll get to more in future episodes. He was a friend of Poggio,
right.
Also a friend of the Medici, and he left it to the Medici when he died, and that's how it ended up in Lorenzo de Medici's library.
Wow.
So there you go. Like...
It's like time travel.
Mind-boggling. Yes,
absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mind-boggling that these things survived in a single manuscript, and some of the books never survived. Half of them never survived.
Right.
Including these couple of years when the whole thing between Tiberius and Sejanus
mm-hmm.
is going down.
Ah.
We only have Cassius Dio and Suetonius.
Mm-hmm.
They give us a fairly abbreviated account. Like Tacitus would have spent three books explaining the nitty gritty of what went on here. They cover it in a couple of pages.
Oh.
But we got what we got.
Right. As a kid say in my kid's school, you get what you get and you don't throw a fit. That is actually their motto.
Is that what they say?
Yeah, and we will adopt that here.
So,
yeah,
we don't know how the impasse between the Senate and Thibaut was resolved regarding Agrippina and Nero.
Yeah.
We do know, though, that one of the leading figures in their eventual prosecution was Aulus Avilius Flaccus,
mm-hmm.
who became prefect of Egypt then in 32, must have been after Seneca the Younger's uncle died or retired. Now, this Flaccus should not be confused with Uppity Softy. That was Lucius Pomponius Flaccus.
Right.
This is a different Softy. It was this Softy, this Flaccus, by the way, who,
mm-hmm.
when he was prefect of Egypt, permitted a mob to erect statues of Caligula in the Jewish synagogues of Alexandria.
Ooh. Was he looking to get circumcised forcibly? I mean, don't piss off the Jews. Come on.
I think the Jews shouldn't piss off the Romans.
That's true.
So it was this erection of these statues of Caligula, who wanted to be treated as a god in his lifetime, in the synagogues that, according to Philo of Alexandria, the great Jewish historian and scholar,
mm-hmm.
then writes that Flaccus was destroying the synagogues, not leaving even their name. Apparently the Jews resisted the erection of the statues with force, and Flaccus just destroyed them. In response, Flaccus says he then issued a notice...
Right.
In which he called us, Philo's writing here, he called us, meaning the Jews, he called us all foreigners and aliens, allowing anyone who was inclined to proceed to exterminate the Jews as prisoners of war.
Damn.
Philo says that in response, the mobs drove the Jews entirely out of four quarters and crammed them all into a very small portion of one, while the populace, overrunning their desolate houses, turned to plunder and divided the booty among themselves as if they had obtained it in war. Philo also says that their enemies slew them and thousands of others with all kinds of agony and tortures and newly invented cruelties, for wherever they met with or caught sight of a Jew, they stoned him or beat him with sticks. The most merciless of all their persecutors, in some instances, burnt whole families, husbands with their wives and infant children with their parents in the middle of the city, sparing neither age nor youth, nor the innocent helplessness of infants. Some men, he said, were dragged to death, while those who did these things mimicked the sufferers like people employed in the representation of theatrical farces. Other Jews, he said, were crucified.
Jeez.
Coincidentally,
right?
It was around this time, 32-33 CE, that a small group of Jews started claiming that a crucified Jew was actually the long-awaited Messiah. So,
yeah,
the Jews, this is before the Jewish-Roman War,
right,
that happens in Jerusalem in 66. This is 30 years before that. The Jews kick up a fuss in Alexandria, which isn't very far from Syria or Judea, and they get slaughtered in their thousands, burnt, crucified.
Yes.
And then just up the road a little bit, the Jews start saying, oh, well, we had a crucified Jew too.
But.
And he's actually
the
Messiah.
Right. So smoke that in your pipe. When you hear about people in modern times hating Jews, one of the things that's the reasons is because, you know, they were directly or indirectly involved in having Christ killed. I get that. So if it's 32 CE and this Roman is having all these Jews killed, it has to be for a different reason. Is it just because they revolted, or they stood up for themselves after Caligula wanted his statue in the in their temples? Or is it just because of the Jews are different, they don't conform, they don't worship our gods, and so they're different and they should be treated like animals?
Yes. So this this instance in Alexandria was, yes, because it was against Jewish law to erect statues of other gods. Mm-hmm. Caligula wanted to be treated as a god. And they had been given permission by the Romans not to have to do that. I mean, remember, since Julius Caesar, the Jews had been given sort of carte blanche. The history of Roman intercession with Judea is they, you know, before the civil war, Caesar-Pompey civil war, the Jews had kind of had a certain degree of independence. They were run by the Greeks. Judea was run by Seleucus's empire for hundreds of years. Then when the Romans defeated Seleucus, the Jews had some independence with the Hasmonean kings for about 100 years. Then the Romans got more involved, and that's when they ended the Hasmonean kings, and they put Herod's family in control,
right,
and sort of ran it as a province for a generation or two. Then finally, during the reign of Augustus, we talked about this, Julius Caesar, the Jews supported Julius Caesar in his civil war with Pompey. Therefore, afterwards, he gave them sort of a bit of carte blanche.
Right.
Yeah, we'll be nice to you. Do whatever you want with your crazy religions, okay? you look, you had my back, I'll have your back.
Yeah.
He enabled them to get back to sort of a, I think, a Hasmonean high priest. And then Augustus looked fairly favorably upon them, give, you know, mostly he was okay with the Jews, thought they were kind of cute and funny. And even though he was the one that finally, I think when Herod's kids died, Augustus said, right, well, okay, let's just make you, you're part of the empire now. Thanks very much.
Right.
Then, I remember us saying there was an instance early on in Tiberius's reign where he had some problems with Jews that were taking Roman women and turning them into temple prostitutes or something. So he had a bit of an issue with the Romans, with the Jews. But here what's happening, is now Caligula wants to be treated by the Jews as a god. He wants to erect statues of himself as a god in their synagogues, and they kick up a fuss, probably expecting Yahweh to send the Messiah.
Sure.
as people who have seen my film, which is nobody, knows that but I've talked about this a million times.
Right.
According to tradition, the Messiah was going to be a warrior king. Arr. He was a man. He wasn't man's some, man. You know, divine thing that happens to you when you die. The Messiah was a human, beloved by God, but just a man
Like
who was a warrior, a great soldier, a general, and a king in the style of King David,
right,
who would help the Jews rise up and defeat their enemies. At this time, there would have been the Romans, the occupiers. Whenever the Jews rebelled, which happened, sort of, there was a mini rebellion around about 6 CE, I think, was the first one.
Mm-hmm.
And then there was this other one later on, the first big Jewish-Roman war in 66, and then there was another one about 60 years later. But whenever they rose up, some of these rebellious Jewish groups, the Sicarii and these sorts of guys who were like the assassins, they kind of half expected that Yahweh would send the Messiah to help them. One of their guys was the Messiah. Yeah, this is it. All right, we've been talking about this for 800 years. Here it is, boys and girls. We were talking about it back when the Persians were the enemy.
Right.
And then the Greeks became the enemy. Oh. And now the Romans are the enemy. Yeah. Any day now.
But at long last.
Yahweh is going to send that fucking Messiah. this is it. We're going to win. It's going to get good. And so I'm pretty sure that these guys in Alexandria thought this would happen as well. Anyway, as we know too, when Alexandria was established by Ptolemy the second, really, I mean, who moved there. Listeners to our Alexander show know this. Alexandria was established by Alexander himself. And then when Ptolemy, one of his generals, took over Egypt, he sort of started building it up to be the capital.
Mm-hmm.
The capital at the time was Memphis. But really, Ptolemy was probably dead, and it was his son, Ptolemy the second, who Ptolemy Philadelphus, who moved the capital from Memphis to Alexandria in the sort of middle of the second century BCE, and took Alexander's body with him, which then disappeared.
Right,
and we were going to do a we were going to make a film about that, but never happened. Where was it? And then it was Ptolemy Philadelphus, who actually got that's when the Library of Alexandria was established, and he got a group of 70 Jewish scholars to translate the Tanakh, the Old Testament, from Hebrew into Greek, which became the Septuagint, the writing of the 70. Which was known as the Old Testament then during the Greek period. What the guys who wrote the New Testament, guys like Matthew and Mark and those guys who were writing the Gospels, they didn't speak Hebrew because they weren't Jews. Mm-hmm. They were Greeks. They were Gentiles, the writers of the New Testament.
Right.
So, except for Paul. But the other guys, the Gospel writers, were Greeks. Or Greek Romans, they were Gentiles, but they spoke Greek. And when they were referencing the Old Testament, they were referencing the Septuagint, the Greek version of it, not the Hebrew, because they couldn't fucking read Hebrew. And that's how, as I point out in the documentary, the first appearance of Mary being a virgin appears in the Gospel of Matthew. And it appears because there was a translation error in the Septuagint, in the Greek version. The Greek version quotes the book of Isaiah, which says, a child will be born to an Alma. Now, an Alma in Hebrew actually translates as young woman.
Mm-hmm.
But when they were translating it into Greek for the Septuagint, they mistranslated Alma as virgin. It should have been just young woman.
Right.
But they mistranslated it as virgin. Then Matthew is looking for stories to write. And he writes, he must have been born of a virgin because Isaiah says the child will be born of a virgin and hence like a virgin.
Fuck. So
when
I was a Catholic, that's fine. When I was a Catholic and I'm doing all these repeating these sayings or whatever, and then you got the virgin birth, which is pretty much shoved in your face. Bad images necessary. But the point is, so this gets shoved in my face about being born of the Virgin Mary. It was all because of a translation mistake.
Yeah.
That, just a mind fuck.
Yeah.
Thank you for that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. The whole Mary was a virgin thing was a translation error.
Jesus Christ. So God
exactly.
Did,
yes.
Did rape
Jesus
her?
Christ.
God, so God either raped her, had consensual sex because she was impressed by anybody, with money and out of town, or was a Joe's child, but God was working through Joseph.
Let's not get distracted.
Okay, let's not. Sorry,
I've already
sorry.
Got us distracted.
Nero.
Yes, the Jews rose up.
Yes. Yeah, sorry.
Yes. Anyway, back to Agrippina and Nero with the last 10 minutes we have left. So Nero was declared a public enemy by the Senate.
Yes.
And while this was going on, he and his mother were both removed from the court for security reasons. And I actually have a recording of this happening.
Oh, nice.
Here it is.
Security! This dude needs a guard. He needs a guard.
There you go. That was them calling out for security.
So
now, for their own safety,
right.
They were chained, thrown into a closed litter, and placed under a heavy guard for their own safety.
What?
Right.
Okay. All right. Yeah. And like you've already said, Flaccus was one of the more extreme of the prosecutors, and he's going to get a big reward because if you remember from previous shows, to be the prefect of Egypt was a big fucking deal. If you were a Roman of note, you couldn't go there without, as far as I remember, express written permission from the princeps. It was his domain. So that's quite a reward for him. And so these two, and I guess at least we can say, even though they're being treated like shit, it's not like they were just taken out and killed. They're both going to be exiled far away. And I guess instead of being killed and the fact that they're exiled, is that the Senate trying to placate Tiberius and not going too far themselves? Or maybe was that what he wanted to happen to these two enemies of the state?
We don't know. Yeah, probably.
Okay.
I mean, that's probably
that's right,
the way
the
it
records
was
are sketchy.
Still done. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, we don't know.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. Nero was exiled on the island of Pontia for his own safety. Look, this is going to hurt us more than it's hurting you, Nero.
Right.
Like, trust us. This is for your own safety. Agrippina was exiled to the island of Pandateria, today known as Ventotene, the same place where her mother. Julia the slut whore had been exiled. Now, it's not far from Capri, actually, and maybe Thibaut was doing them a favor. He was like, hey, baby, come join the island life. We live on islands now. It's so much better, man. Listen to Jimmy Buffett. Smoke up some weed. It's all good, man.
Ganja. Ganja. Yeah.
Rome is disgusting and noisy. Come and live the island life. He's a good guy, Tibo. He's just trying to help them out.
Yeah.
Listen.
He's doing them a favor. Yeah.
Doing you a favor. Exactly.
Yeah.
But that said.
Yes. Yes.
After you, sir.
Well, there's a difference between exile. You know, everybody, if you live long enough, you're going to be exiled for something, and hopefully you're going to be allowed to come back one day. Exile is one thing, torture is something else.
Yeah. Go on.
Agrippina, and you don't... Oh, and again, this is what kills me about the records being scarce. We don't know what Thibaut knew about this. But the point is, Agrippina wasn't just exiled. She was beaten. She was tortured. At one point, supposedly, And I don't know, I kind of can see this because she's got a mouth on her. But supposedly she insults Thibaut and the centurion, who is just so fucking loyal to Tiberius, beats her so bad she loses an eye. And because she's the proud daughter, she's got the blood in her. Mm. She's got the royal blood in her. She decides to starve herself to death to take the satisfaction away from them. But they won't even allow that. She is, like others have been, force-fed.
Mm. How do you force-feed somebody in 30 CE who's got one eye?
Yeah. Well, obviously, you sneak up on them on that side where they've lost eye and they can't see you. And you shove a spoon of gruel in their mouth. And I don't know. But the point is you're making is today you can just shove an IV and give them nutrients and fluid and all this stuff. You literally have to force them to eat. And I just imagine her life was complete shit on that island. Mm. And it's going to get worse. It's going to get worse.
Then in the year 30, Thibaut finally went after his arch nemesis, Asinius Gallus, the man who banged Thibaut's, not only his ex-wife, but the love of his life, Vipsania, and then was a constant pain in Thibaut's ass, and not in a good way,
no,
for 15 years.
Yeah. Now, Gallus might have been virile because I think him and Vipsania had several children, numerous children. He might have been in some ways politically stupid, but even by now he's sticking his wet finger in the air and he's seeing how the winds are blowing. So he hasn't completely lost his senses. By 29, he is majorly sucking up to Sienus because if you want to get anywhere, hell, if you just want to survive, you've got to be on this man's good side because he is the power now. So at least he's doing that right. But just like you said, it's done. It's over. For too many years, he's been an embarrassment and a pain to the princeps.
And this is another thing that the I Claudius got wrong, because they actually show Gallus getting taken down. But the way it happened, according to, I think, Suetonius, the way it went down is that Thibaut invited Gallus to
Capri?
A banquet in his honor on the island of Capri.
If
rule number two, Gallus.
Involved. That's right. Someone's going to die.
He's like, listen, Gallus, old friend. Look, it's a lot of water under the bridge with us. Like, we haven't always seen eye to eye. We know that. But Vipsania is dead. Yeah. Livy is dead. Julie is dead. We're old
guys.
Men.
Yeah.
It's time to...
Passions have healed, Carl.
Hug it out.
Hug it out, bitch. Yeah.
Listen, come to Capri. I'll throw on some food. Then we'll spend a lazy afternoon and night in my sex dungeon.
Right.
You're going to love it. I've got women cut by our plastic surgeons to look like Vipsania. And Julia.
I'm getting aroused.
Fucked the first one. I whipped the second one. You're going to love it. It's seriously messed up and
a good
kinky.
Time. Yeah.
Yeah, have a good time. And I've got a bunch of them cut to look like my mother. You don't want to know what I do with that one.
I do. God.
And come scene. To Capri. We'll have a great time. And Gallus, being an idiot... Yes. I mean, what he is doing, though. Like, you can't go, listen, Thibaut, thanks, but what day did you say? Tuesday?
Yeah.
No, look, I'd love to, but Tuesday I'm...
My anus is being bleached. I can't, sorry.
Yeah.
I don't know.
I've got a hair appointment on Tuesday, and...
That's better. That's better. I apologize.
I can't make it. Anyway, so on the same day, Gallus is having lunch on Capri.
Yes.
Looking forward to getting into those
cut
models in the sex dungeon.
Right.
The very same day, a letter from Thibault is read out in the Senate accusing him of expressing jealousy at Tiberius's friendship with Sejanus. That's the best that he can come up with.
Yes, but it doesn't matter because the Senate is a rubber stamp now. But the fact that Thibault had to time this out, do you know what we call this at CSI? Premeditated. Premeditated. Pre-fucking meditate. Oh, this is... But see, we've talked about this before, how we've had to adjust, we've had to correct Tiberius's real personality, real character, where he really cared at one point about Rome. But you're about to find out that this guy, I mean, to be smart is one thing, but he's been around for decades. He's an old man now. He's seen it all. This guy is as clever as a fox. He's as devious as he needs to be. And he has the ability. He's basically the first Machiavelli. He is going to be able to put shit together and just run circles around people that think that they know him or that they can control him. This guy is devious.
So the Senate were in such a state at this stage that they immediately condemned Gallus to execution. A senator had been a senator for decades.
Yeah.
To execution for expressing jealousy at Tiberius's friendship with Sejanus.
I wish Thibault was my really good friend like he is with Sejanus. Yeah, I banged his first wife, but I would really like... I think I'd be a good friend. I think I'd be a really good friend to him. And that got
It's not
killed.
Even Maestas. It's not even...
Exactly.
You know, he's trying to have me killed. There's a conspiracy. It's just he's jealous of me. And they're like, yep, kill him.
Yep.
But...
Jesus Christ.
But... Right? Thibault wouldn't allow him to be executed until he was in Rome to witness it himself. Now, I'm assuming that he set this whole thing up. So, okay, so Gallus is having lunch. This letter's read out in the Senate. The senator sentenced him to death. But they're in Rome. And these guys are in Capri. Like that's a day's, at least a couple of days ride, you know, away. So news is going to take a couple of days to get from Rome back to Capri with what the Senate's decided. Thibault must have kept him there because what's the point? The whole point of this has to be that Thibault can see the look on his face and he can see the look on Thibault's face.
Right.
When he is arrested by the Praetorians and his sentence is read out to him.
Fucking A. It's good to be the king. And Gallus, knowing how this is going to go down, he is ready to kill himself. But Thibault doesn't want that either.
Thibault must have kept him around for a couple of days just to see the look on his face.
Yes, and got off.
And just to grin. Just to like...
just a shit-eaten grin.
How's Vipsanti? Tell me again how Vipsanti's pussy tasted, will you? Just tell me one more time. Oh, because I never get sick of hearing you talk about how tight her pussy was. Oh, she had five kids and still, you know, it was like a vice, that pussy. Yeah. Lips the grip, baby. Like really, I never got sick of hearing, please. Yeah, tell me one more time, bitch.
Oh, my God, this guy. And even if you were a historian and you liked Tiberius, how do you spin this? There's no way to spin this. This was premeditated. This was planned out. This guy was not allowed to kill himself, and he wasn't to be killed until Thibault comes back to Rome. Thibault knows he's not going back to Rome. This is payback with a capital P.
Well, the way that you would spin it is you say, well, Suetonius is writing this 70 years later.
Right.
Two generations later, under the reign of, I don't know, Vespasian or Trajan or somebody. I mean, how much Julio Claudians have gone and we lived through Caligula and Nero. No one's really got any very fond memories of the decline of Rome under the Julio Claudians. I mean, right. You can just, this could be propaganda, just writing shit about Tiberius. I mean, and it could be, we don't know how much truth there is to this, right? We know, you know, we again, as we always say, we don't know what really happened because our sources are few and far and probably biased, but this is the story as it's come down to us anyway. And it's a great story. Gallus offers to commit suicide, but Thibaut won't let him. He has him arrested, taken to Rome, and held in solitary confinement for 4 years. He kept trying to starve himself to death, but like Agrippina, he was force-fed. They fed him just enough to keep him alive. And Thibaut said, we will execute him when I come back to Rome. Which, of course, he had no intention of ever coming back to Rome. Gallus did finally die of starvation in 33.
Payback delivered.
Wow.
Yeah. Don't fuck with Tiberius.
Here's what Suetonius writes.
Oh, go ahead.
Suetonius writes about Gallus's imprisonment. He had no companion or servant with him, spoke to no one, and saw no one, except when he was compelled to take food. And the food was of such quality and amount as neither to afford him any satisfaction or strength, nor yet to allow him to die. This was, in fact, the most terrible part of his punishment. Tiberius did the same thing in the case of several others. For instance, he imprisoned one of his companions, and then, when there was talk about executing him, he said, "I have not yet made my peace with him." Another man he tortured very severely, and then, on ascertaining that the victim had been unjustly accused, he caused him to be killed with all speed, declaring that he had been too terribly outraged to live with honour. Syriacus, who had neither committed nor been charged with any wrong, but was renowned for his culture, was slain merely because Tiberius declared he was a friend of Gallus.
Damn. Tiberius just sits there quiet, and then when he strikes fast and hard.
Well, that's this episode.
And on a high note.
Tiberius and Sienus, at the height of their depravity. In our next episode, we will, if we have time, cover the end. I got a little bit distracted with the whole Jesus thing on this one. Took up a bit more time than I expected. We will get to the end of Sienus. Yes. The downfall of Sienus next week on the show.
Socrates! Socrates! This dude needs a go. He needs a go.